the FOR and Sowers of Justice Network are so excited to be back together again at a third Thursday lunch. Our last lunch in person was in February of 2020, and that was 3.5 years ago. In the meantime, we have been Zooming programs to you all, but it is possible to be back together, and that is really special. But to begin the program, I want to thank the staff here at Hotel Louisville for making this lunch possible. Chris Gordon, Nina Mosley, and Heather Bass, and many others whose names I don't know, have made it possible for us to come back together again in a really elegant way here. For those of you who are not familiar with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, this is an introduction to the Louisville chapter. We are part of an international organization which got started as a result of the First World War. The American chapter was formed in about 1923, and some of the important things you need to know is that H.A. Musty, one of the founders of FOR, was instrumental in organizing and starting the American Civil Liberties Union. Though we do not, I can only highlight certain things, but at the start of his career as a civil rights leader, Dr. King became a member of FOR. And many of the freedom riders on those buses that were attacked as they made their way to the South at the beginning of the civil rights movement were members of the fellowship as well. But we have been here working, and these lunches are the result of our wanting to bring in speakers to give new insights and perspectives on current events and social issues. And so with that, I'm going to give the mic to Jim Johnson with Forward Radio, and he is going to talk to you about other ways that you can hear Kyle's presentation into the future. So, Jim.
Good evening, folks. It's glad to see you all here today. I'm Jim Johnson. I'm the co-producer of Solutions of Violence at Arizona WFMP 106.5 FM Radio. And it is my duty to explain to you that this Thursday lunch will be recorded and it will air on Solutions of Violence September 25th, 26th, and 27th. Solutions of Violence airs at 5 p.m. on Mondays, 8 a.m. on Tuesdays, and 6 a.m. on Wednesdays. It's also live stream. You can reach us live stream if you visit our website, forwardradio.org, and click on Listen Live Now. There will be a Q&A session after the Kyle Ellison presentation. We welcome you to ask questions, but please state your name so that our radio audience knows who is talking. Beverly Armion will introduce Kyle Ellison. Thank you very much.
Kyle is going to give you his own biography, so I will not say something that he will probably repeat after me. But in any case, though Kyle is the unofficial prison history historian in Kentucky and retired from the Kentucky Department of Corrections back in 1988, he has not left this field. And through his research and constant contact with colleagues, he has maintained a steady research effort to find and keep up with prison issues, prisoner issues, and so forth. So we are not going to hear a history today. We are going to be talking about current events, current things that we, as citizens of Louisville and Jefferson County, need to know in order to connect with our elected officials on the subjects that deal with prisoners and prisons, jails in this area. So, Kyle, take it away here.
Thank you for inviting me to speak today. I have followed incarceration issues in Kentucky for over 50 years. I came home woke from the Vietnam War in 1972 and became a probation and parole officer in Louisville for the next 9 years. I had slept through the anti-war and civil rights movements and was determined to make up for lost time. I worked for the Kentucky Department of Corrections for 16 years. From 1981 to 1988, I trained prison and jail personnel all over Kentucky. During that time, I researched and wrote about the state's prison history and did the exhibit that you see here today. After resigning in 1988, I kept up with corrections issues, but didn't really write about it until 2017 when Kentucky Department of Corrections returned to using private prisons. This is actually, they returned to using it for the third time because the first time was in 1825. I am part of a small group of retired Department of Corrections employees who have worked during the past 60 years. We remember when things were better and how things got worse. It is this support system, and this includes all of you here today that enables all of us to persevere against forces that can be overwhelming. Here's a rabbi's story to illustrate this point. A member of the congregation noticed that his rabbi spent a lot of time and effort doing good works, even though his chances for making significant changes in the system were slim. The member asked, "Rabbi, why do you go to all this trouble? You know you aren't going to change the system." The rabbi said, "You're right. I'm not going to change the system, but I'm going to make sure the system does not change me." And so with this attitude, this is kind of the attitude that I've worked with. Today I'm going to talk about how 15 Metro jail deaths moved our jail from the shadows and onto the newspaper front pages. I'm going to talk about the differences between state prisons and county jails and how Metro Jail fits into our 74 county jails and 14 Kentucky Department of Corrections prisons. I'm going to talk about what we can do now instead of building a new jail, and then how we can focus our reform efforts to enable changes over the long term. I will answer every question, but not during my talk. Maybe you could write them down. I'm going to use approximate numbers. These figures change every day. If you want a copy of my remarks today, you can check out the FOR website or email me directly. I'd like to start with the 15 deaths. Conditions that enabled high jail death rates at Metro Jail were occurring all over the United States during the pandemic. A correctional officer at Metro Jail died of COVID. The pandemic, combined with low pay, led to serious staff shortage. Correctional officers often work 16-hour shifts, resulting in $4 million of overtime pay. This all but guaranteed security lapses. The jail did not have strong leadership and was so shorthanded that needed terminations did not happen. Starting salaries for correctional officers were and still are so low that new recruits are hard to find. Fentanyl, the most deadly drug ever, became cheap and readily available. A shorthanded staff could not keep it out of the jail. Payments for drugs and people to bring them into the jail could all take place outside the jail using a variety of online payment apps, lessening the chances of getting caught in a cash exchange. The spectacular series of deaths created public demand for changes. Metro Council commissioned a $30,000, 450-page investigation of the jail deaths by David Beyer, a retired law enforcement officer. I'm going to refer to this as the Beyer investigation. The main conclusion of this report is that we need a new jail. Securing adequate staffing levels is also prominently featured in the report. Recidivism rates of 70% are mentioned, but rehabilitation and treatment programs don't get much attention. Not mentioned in the investigation is the 46 deaths of people on a home incarceration program, this is the ankle bracelet, that occurred from 2017 to 2022. Since I'm going to talk about both state prisons and county jails, I'm going to take a minute to describe the differences between serving time in a jail versus serving time in a state prison. Jails are designed for short-term confinement, and living space is minimal. Jails have high numbers of incoming people, and staff know nothing about their problems. People are in jail for many different reasons. Overcrowding is common. University of Kentucky law professor Robert Lawson, by the way, he wrote the state penal code in 1974, he noted in one of the papers that he published, quote, "Many jails give each person the same amount of space that an animal shelter might give a large dog," unquote. There's limited opportunity to separate people from each other, young from old, dangerous from passive, suicidal from detox, or psychotic from normal. Meeting space for academic classes or treatment groups is limited. There's no space or equipment for vocational training. Recreation space may be taken up by prisoners sleeping on the floor. Prisoners may never get to go outside at all. Space for church services, libraries, or family visitation may not exist. Most jail prisoners live in pods where everyone is subjected to the behavior of a single prisoner who acts out. These conditions can exacerbate mental illness and create PTSD. People are released worse off than they were when they went in. On the other hand, state prisons are designed for long-term confinement and have space to eliminate these problems. I'm going to get back to the Metro Jail here. Metro Jail is the largest single lockup except for one prison in the entire state of Kentucky. We have more bed space than any other prison except one. That said, Metro Jail only has 6% of the total 21,000 people in our 74 county jails. 6%. Kentucky Department of Corrections has about 19,000 state prisoners altogether. About 64% of these are in a state prison, but over 8,000 are currently held in a county jail instead of a state prison. Hundreds of these state-sentenced prisoners back up at our metro jail. Many states hold state prisoners in jails, but Louisiana is the only state that has more state prisoners held in county jails than Kentucky. Kentucky is the only state with a state law mandating use of jails for people serving 5 years or less, sometimes called Class D felonies. These are younger people who could benefit the most from educational and treatment programs offered in state prisons. Metro Jail is short-staffed, but Kentucky state prisons are also short-staffed. Some of our state prisons are 70% short-staffed. Kentucky State Penitentiary at Eddyville is operating at half capacity. Metro Jail holds almost three times as many people as Kentucky State Penitentiary. Kentucky has not built a new state prison since 2004. Instead, it pays county jails a per diem to hold state prisoners. The rate is about $33 per day. Current per diem costs for Metro Jail are about four times higher. Earlier this month, jail count sheets showed 130 state prisoners held at Metro Jail. For 2021, the average number of state prisoners at Metro Jail was 280. Metro Jail has struggled for over 40 years to get Kentucky Department of Corrections to take all convicted state prisoners out of our jail. If we build a new jail, Kentucky Department of Corrections will force us to keep even more state prisoners. Each of these prisoners will cost Louisville taxpayers about $100 a day more than the per diem. As Hank Williams said in a song, "Move over, little dog, 'cause the big dog's moving in." So there is this conflictual relationship between the state prisons and the county jails. Kentucky is the only state that elects jailers. They are an influential part of county and state politics. Over 40 counties elect and pay jailers, even though there is no jail in that county. The Kentucky Jailers Association hires a legislative lobbyist to advocate for their interests. Jailers are currently suing the Department of Corrections to increase the state per diem rate. Metro Jail is not on their list of concerns. Large jails like Metro and Metro Jail in Fayette County do not elect jailers. They appoint administrators. Jails that overcrowd make more money from per diem payments. Last year, 10 jails, all located in southeast Kentucky, operated at an average of 190% overcrowded. Pulaski County Jail is now over 200% of capacity. One-third of the people held there are state or federal prisoners that pay per diem. In 2006, the jailer in Pulaski County was quoted in the Courier-Journal saying, quote, "It does pay to overcrowd your jail," end quote. Kentucky Department of Corrections has statutory authority to lower jail overcrowding, but it has no place to put the prisoners if it does. The Department of Corrections does have jail inspectors, but they lack authority to make significant changes. You probably have not heard about this, but just last week there were five deputy jailer staff at Boyd County, that's Ashland, who were sentenced to prison for terms up to 20 years in the beating death of an inmate. This occurred in 2018. I looked up the overcrowding rate for that jail in 2018, and it was 150%. And I looked up the overcrowding rate for the Boyd County Jail today, and it's gone down to 149%. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that is not in the news in Jefferson County. So these are a lot of numbers, and numbers make people's eyes glaze over, I know. So I want to change focus and tell a few stories about my experiences in corrections. For all of Kentucky's prisons, the mid-1960s and 1970s was the golden era for community treatment and rehabilitation programs. As a probation and parole officer in the 1970s, I did my best to keep people out of prison. I had a caseload low enough to allow me to get to know my clients, jobs were available, and many people coming out of prison had benefited from vocational and academic training. Sentences were much shorter back then, and parole rates were higher. fire. I was making a difference, and it mattered. One day, a man in his mid-50s walked into my office for his first visit. He had served about a year in prison. It was immediately obvious that he could not hear very well, and he was very good at hiding that fact. I asked if he had had any examination of his hearing at the reformatory, and he answered no. It took me 6 weeks, but I got vocational rehabilitation to buy him a hearing aid. He had lived with only 10% hearing in one ear almost all his life. He thought maybe he had lost his hearing as a result of a disease, but it happened when he was too young to remember. I sat on the edge of my chair as he walked into my office for the first time with his new hearing aid. He now had 40% hearing in one ear. He said, "Mr. Ellison, it's wonderful. I can hear the commode flush now. Traffic is so loud, I have to turn it off." He never got into trouble again. I remember making a home placement visit and looking around and realizing there was nothing in print in the entire house. No one there could read. The more I saw, the more I came to wonder why more people, given the conditions they grew up in, lived in, were not in prison. I still feel that way. The first time a person on parole asked me to take him back to the reformatory, I was dumbfounded. I explained that they really did not want him back. That night, he broke into a used car lot and called the police on himself. He got a year to serve. 2 weeks before his release date, he walked away from a minimum security prison and was picked up hitchhiking on the interstate 2 hours later. The next person who asked me to return him to the reformatory was on parole for a violent crime and had violated a no-contact condition of his parole. He forced me to return him to prison, where he served an additional 18 months and was paroled again. He then forced his new parole officer to return him to prison again. Many clients asked to be returned to prison with self-defeating behaviors instead of just coming right out and saying so. It is hard to work with someone who no longer cares, someone who finds life in prison better or just has no other place to live. In 2021, almost 1,100 people on Metro Jail's home incarceration program went back to jail because they'd had no place to live. In 2021, there were 17 deaths of people on home incarceration. Some of these people might have been housed at the Community Corrections Center, but it closed with the onset of COVID and remains closed today. I'm going to come back to the Community Corrections Center. Through the 1970s, probation and parole caseloads kept increasing. By 1981, they had doubled. Opportunities for my clients were fewer, and I spent all my time on crisis intervention. I burned out. I was becoming someone unable to really care anymore about those I supervised. I transferred to a job as a staff training officer for the Department of Corrections and jail personnel. I can never do casework again. In 1972, there were 6,000 Kentuckians on probation and parole. Today, there are 60,000. I often wonder what happens when police officers and jail personnel burn out but are trapped by the job or retirement system. We would be wise to think more about that. I have more stories best left for another time. I want to shift back to the Metro Jail again. We are now at a critical point for making decisions that will affect what happens at Metro Jail for the next 60 years. It is good that the rush towards a new jail has slowed down for now, but I am not counting on that to continue. In spite of the bad news, some of the numbers are better. In 2009, there were 47,000 admissions to the Metro Jail. In 2021, there were only 17,000 admissions. During the past 12 months, Metro Jail's population has decreased 12%. Since 2009, the number of arrests by Metro Police has dropped about 50%. This lull gives us an opportunity to plan the future. Earlier this month, the new online dashboard, the name of it is the dashboard. It's the information link for the Metro Corrections Jail. It showed only 60 state prisoners backed up into Metro Jail. The Department of Corrections count sheet for that same day noted twice as many. In May 2023, at the meeting of the Metro Justice Criminal Justice Commission Jail Policy Committee, noted an average number of state sentenced prisoners at Metro Jail was 157. This is better than 2016, when the average number of state prisoners backed up at Metro Jail was 260. So there is some improvement, but it is important to remember that conditions remain in place to cause the number of state prisoners at Metro Jail to rise again. What can we do now instead of spending hundreds of millions for a new jail. We have a 457-page investigation of jail deaths. We should demand a similar report about treatment and rehabilitation programs. This would include treatment for drug detox, mental health, pre-release casework, post-release support, and housing. A 70% recidivism rate begs for more study. There are no reports on how much of the jail's budget is spent on treatment programs. One story in the Beyer investigation tells about a prisoner who came in to the Metro Jail with mental illness, and he came into the jail about once a month for 16 years. Today's Courier Journal reports that two-thirds of Metro Jail's population have drug abuse and or mental health problems. Jails make these people worse. A substantial number of jail and home incarceration deaths come from unrelated medical issues. Like my client with the hearing aid, many people at Metro never see a doctor any other place. Metro Jail does protect us from some dangerous people, but it is being used as a human disposal for a myriad of problems. Detox and mental health treatment services need to be provided in the community to help people avoid going to jail. It is not just treatment in the jail that should be studied. We need to know how these services are and are not provided in all of Metro Louisville. At Metro Jail, we are struggling to recruit enough staff to fill basic security needs. Salary levels have been raised and will need to be raised again. Kentucky Department of Corrections has raised starting pay for a correctional officer to $50,000 a year. This is higher than Metro Jail pays. In Reno, Nevada, jail staff start at $75,000 a year. This is as much or more than state police and other law enforcement agencies pay. Police officers transfer to work into the jail. Making police and corrections jobs interchangeable would go a long way towards preventing burnout. Since the onset of COVID, the 445-bed Community Corrections Center has remained closed due to lack of staff. The CCC, as I call it, is on East Chestnut Street near hospitals and could be used for mental health and detox treatment. The Beyer investigation and many correctional officers recommended reopening the Community Corrections Center. I learned 3 days ago from Deputy Mayor David James that a decision has been made not to reopen Community Corrections Center, but to tear it down instead. He said that with fentanyl, there is no way to have a facility where people often come in and out. This is one-third of the size of the jail that we have, and this is where treatment programs and work release could happen. So I was surprised to hear that, so I think this is an issue that we should raise with our elected officials right away. How can we focus our reform efforts? Stop depending on crisis-driven accountability. Lasting change is not going to happen just because the media prints stories of dramatic events at the jail. We need to keep up with what is happening. Our jail needs to make it easier to do that. A new jail dashboard is a step in the right direction, and credit should be given. This online resource provides basic information about Metro jail population on a daily basis. The dashboard needs to be improved to make it user-friendly, make it a user-friendly public research tool. It should include information about current staffing levels, recidivism rates, and deaths on home incarceration. The annual report for Metro Jail needs a lot more attention. Anybody ever see the annual report for the Metro Jail? These reports are one-page summaries called fact sheets that cover the entire year. We are managing a $72 million per year jail, and the public has access to a one-page report. What could go wrong here? These annual reports go back 10 years, but reports for 2014 and 2022 are missing. The daily dashboard information link only goes back about 15 months and does not include the summaries available on the fact sheet annual reports. There is almost nothing in the annual fact sheet report to inform the public how $10 million is used by private contractors at the jail. Medical care, food service, communication and telephone service, and commissary services are all contracted out. So jail's being privatized from the inside out. Even basic budget numbers are presented in a way that confuses the public. A Metro Jail budget listed in the city budget at $62 million per year is actually $10 million higher because an additional $10 million comes from the public health and wellness budget for inmate medical care. Metro Jail is the only jail in Kentucky that even has an annual report. If there are other jails that have annual report, I haven't been able to find them. I think failure to inform the public is a vicious circle that keeps jails out of sight and out of mind. We need to demand an independent oversight authority for Metro Jail. In the police department, this would be called a civilian review board. Our report suggests that oversight would be done by internal jail administration, but the jail is proven unable to police itself. An independent oversight board would certainly create aggravations for Metro Jail, but it would be cheaper than waiting for deaths, lawsuits, and federal court orders and paying to patch over one crisis after another. I'm going to summarize some of what I've gone over here. I'm speaking rapidly. We've heard about how the 15 jail deaths focused public attention on the jail and resulted in a huge investigation and calls for a new jail. At the same time, 46 deaths on Metro's home incarceration program fell through the cracks. It seems we only care about the prisoners who die in the jail. Staff shortage caused closure of Community Correction Center, and Metro jail staffing levels remain a concern. How much a concern should we be about jail staff? Well, I don't know, and I'm not sure the public knows what the staff situation is at the jail. Without any public discussion, it has been decided to tear down the Community Corrections Center. This curtails a variety of treatment options. The insignificance of Metro Jail in the statewide context of 74 jails and 14 state prisons, and the reasons we are not able to control the backup of state prisoners in our jail. We've also covered the difference between living conditions in jails versus prisons and the lack of publicly available reports about what is going on in our jail, the necessity for independent oversight authority, and how jail deaths are a failure of community resources instead of just a jail problem that can be solved with patchwork crisis intervention or a new jail. What can we do to focus our efforts on change? I want to debunk the idea that the media is going to cause things to change just by printing the truth. The media is vitally important but limited in influence. Stories about jail reform come and go like the weather, but crime is in the news every day, and especially on election days. Here's a little personal story about the media, my experience with the media. In October last year, I wrote an opinion piece about the Metro Jail that appeared on the front page of the forum section of the Courier Journal. My personal email was unexpectedly printed at the end of the article. I thought, I only got 4 or 5 emails from people I did not know, and I got about 30 emails from people that I did know. I came to the conclusion that people do not want to read or think about incarceration issues. You may not have thought of this, but newspapers keep track of how many clicks each article gets to determine what to cover in the future. I learned this from John Cheeves, a reporter at the Lexington Herald Leader, who writes more articles about jails and prisons in Kentucky than anyone. He said that his articles on incarceration get fewer clicks than any other articles in his newspaper. Judging from our Courier Journal, articles about bourbon get a lot of clicks. I would like to emphasize the importance of not giving up hope. Prisons used to have signs on the door, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter." Anybody remember that? They don't have them now, but I clearly remember this. I have come to believe that those signs were meant for all of us who do not enter, not just for prisoners. It is time for all of us to stop believing the abandon hope sign. Here are my thoughts on how to do that. Number one, support each other's efforts. I would not be doing this work without encouraging feedback from groups like LSURG, League of Women Voters, Fellowship of Reconciliation, newspaper reporters, academics, churches, and former prison employees. I have reached out to Metro Council members, and they are responsive to my concerns and appreciate my input for the most part, not all of them. One council member did not know that the Community Corrections Center even existed. I doubt that many council members know about plans to tear it down. Number two, there's power in numbers, even if those numbers are small. We might think of ourselves as body cameras that record the actions of our officials and agencies. Administrators and office holders will behave differently if they think people are watching what they do. Even 2 or 3 people will find their efforts magnified by this effect. Number three, plan for the long haul. Work for small changes that can have a big effect over a period of decades. It has taken 50 years to get into the mess we are in. Stop believing in quick fix reform. A small change might seem like a small change, but getting actually a really informative annual report from the Metro Jail would be a big step. Number four, take in the long-term view of history. Kentucky corrections history tells us that in 1940, at the end of the Depression, Kentucky's prison population was 4,000 people. This was higher than ever before. By 1970, there were less than 3,000 people in our state prisons, a 25% drop. Since 1970, our prison population has increased about 700% to 21,000. The immediate reaction is to blame this huge increase on the drug problem. This is important, but there are other things we might consider. In the mid-1950s, there were almost 8,000 people in Kentucky in mental hospitals. There are less than 400 today. Community treatment was supposed to take care of patients as they were released, but funding fell through the cracks and jails have been used instead. Between 1940 and 1970, there were three wars and the GI Bill. The wealth gap narrowed and the middle class grew, especially if you were white. Since 1970, the wealth gap has grown exponentially. In the United States, one person out of every 1,000 people has as much wealth as the other 999 combined. The correlation of wealth disparity and prison population merits further study. Number five, keep our harsh sentencing laws in mind. Kentucky is the sixth or seventh highest of all states in this regard in terms of harsh sentencing. Today, the average prison sentence in Kentucky is 14 years, higher than ever before. Rates of parole are lower than ever. We are racing to the bottom with states like Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. Fear of crime is used to win elections. Our current governor's race is an example. It is worth noting here that the percentage of Metro Louisville citizens who are serving state prison time is about one-third lower than the rest of Kentucky. In other words, our per capita incarceration rate for Louisville is almost a third less than what's out in the counties. This means we're paying more than our fair share of the $715 million per year cost just for the state prisons. Number six, work towards making public education happen for incarceration issues. Demand that Metro Jail do the daily work of building an infrastructure of accountability through the reports. This means transparent and user-friendly reporting. The internet gives us an opportunity we never had before. Demand that our county jails and state prisons have an office dedicated to proactive public education. We do this for anti-smoking, drunk driving, seat belts, gambling, and the lottery. Waiting for a retired prison employee like me to put all this together in a big picture is not a plan that's going to work for the long term. Waiting for the media to educate the public and elected officials about incarceration is not effective. Crime is in the news every day, and incarceration articles are seldom read. In closing, I want to say the efforts made by those here today to let elected officials know our concerns might be the tipping point necessary to move towards lasting reform for Metro Jail. Most citizens are ignoring this issue, so a small group can have a big impact. The alternative to lasting reform is a vicious circle, a snowball effect, where little by little, things get worse until something big goes wrong. We do not want to end up with a $400 or $500 million new jail and a continuation of the same problems we have right now. So if you're thinking about your questions, I want to tell a brief story. It has to do with the exhibit up here behind me, which I did while I was training personnel. It gave me a means to sort of be interested in something besides repeating stress management or security procedures one for the 100th time that week. This photo exhibit was done by Eastern Kentucky University, the Kentucky Historical Society, and me for the Department of Corrections. Eastern Kentucky University had a copy, the original copy. The Department of Corrections had a copy, and the Kentucky History Center had a copy. All those institutions disappeared my exhibit. They all disappeared me. I take this personally. I call this critical erase theory. This particular exhibit that you have here came in the case over there that has Kentucky Historical Society written on it. I called up to the History Center to get this traveling exhibit for my church. I was informed, the gal there informed me, no, we don't have such an exhibit. I said, well, I think you do because I made it and I named the people that I made it with. So she calls me back the next day. Well, they've been able to locate, they do in fact have the exhibit. great, can you send it down to me? I want to put it up at my church. Well, we don't send that kind of exhibit out anymore. And she seemed pretty vague about the reasons. I said, well, what are you going to do with the exhibit? She said, well, do you want it? I said, well, yeah, I do. So the exhibit that you see here is the exhibit I drove up to Frankfort to get. I got the original exhibit from Eastern Kentucky University. This is the flagship criminal justice training institution in Kentucky. They had the original exhibit. I called down there to a professor. He didn't know where the exhibit was. He finally located it in a crow's nest above a theater. I got that exhibit back in pieces because he was so excited to know it was the originals, he scanned it. But I have that. I have the original prints. Who knows what happened to the Department of Corrections exhibit? They had a copy of this too. Theirs was the first to go. So history can be very inconvenient, and it's nice to have the last laugh in a way to have done this 50 years and say, I'm here to say that you can erase my exhibit, but you can't erase me. So I hope I have not gone on too long. If people have questions, maybe you could ask them loudly or write them down. I will read them off. Ben Reno Weber and Andrew Owen are, but I think it doesn't hurt to approach as many as possible because not that many people will. And one Metro Council member, not those, one Metro Council member, staff person said, well, you know, my member will probably just do whatever the jail wants, whatever the mayor and the jail and the director of the jail decide. Well, I find that hard to swallow. So we need to gang up on some. I'm going to put my speech on the FOR website, and I think it can be sent out as an attachment or a PDF or something. Yes?
We will have, in about 3 days, the text, but also the audio of Kyle's speech today. And when you get there, you will notice that we have the video / audio of about the last 3 years of our program that you can listen to. And all of them are on social justice issues, and they're relevant today. I just want to stand up and say that to answer your question.
Is it FOR.org?
Louisville. FOR.org. Louisville, L-O-U-I-S, et cetera, FOR.org.
I see Dell has his hand up.
Is this scanned copy of your exhibit available online?
No. Oh, well, I don't know how to do it.
Have a student assistant who can do it.
Well, I'm too old for students.
No, but you said a prop. Scan the original.
Well, I don't know where. He died, and I don't know what happened to anything he did.
Okay.
I have found the University of Louisville criminal justice faculty. My experience with them, for the most part, is that I'm stonewalled. I have gone down and lectured to a couple of classes at U of L, but not for the criminal justice faculty.
We need to get you a PhD.
Well, yeah, that'd be convenient. Maybe I'll mail order it. Walt.
Okay. I have the impression that addiction treatment and recovery is kind of a popular issue. And you've told us that 60-70% of the prisoners have addiction problems. Why don't these things intersect?
Well, it's cheaper to lock them up than have anything in the community. I mean, to me, they do. They ought to intersect. I mean, we need to have treatment in the community, readily available treatment, medical-assisted treatment for drug addiction. I don't know if this is still true, but the Public Health and Wellness Cabinet has that program. It sounds really good, and you read through how it's going to help you, but you get to the last line, it says, we are currently not accepting patients. Now, I'm not saying that's still the case, but, you know, it's like we need to do a whole lot more with this. Fentanyl is not going away. There's no such thing as a $200-a-day heroin habit anymore. I mean, fentanyl is just cheap as beer. Yes?
Who are being discharged from prison are more likely to die of an overdose, and I assume that that's because if they haven't gotten drugs in prison, it takes much less to get an overdose, to be killed by an overdose. So, you know, there should be a direct line for people getting out of prison to stay in treatment and to really encourage that. And that seems to not be happening.
One thing that's lacking in the Beyer investigation is very much discussion of jail deaths in other places. Like Oklahoma City is an example of this. They've had twice as many deaths in their jail as we did. And so there was a study done by the Indianapolis Star, and they went back the hard way. They didn't have any reports from the jails in Indiana. And they went back the hard way and figured out how many people had died in jail over a 10-year period. 300 in all of Indiana. And so you can find bits and pieces of this. There's a report out from 2016 by the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting that mentions that there, over the 5-year period, there were 140 jail deaths in Kentucky. And I asked that reporter, Ralph Dunlop, how he got that. Well, he had to file open records requests to get that information. So it isn't just the 15 deaths here. It is happening all over the place. And so, and in the newspaper article today, they talk about during the past 18 months or so, they're making Narcan available to the prisoners themselves at the jail. So prisoners can administer Narcan to each other. This has happened about 20 or 25 times. I'd have to read the article again, just over the past year and a half. So this is one reason we see the jail deaths slowing down. But it's a problem, and it's jails aren't a good way to treat it. Amber.
I was going to mention that point about the Narcan coming into the facility. Director Collins recently told us that they have had over 40 uses of Narcan within the facility. So if the number of deaths at 15 is horrific, imagine if they did not have Narcan in that facility. The other driver of death within the 15 are folks who have died by suicide. So going back to the mental health component, right now there is an RFP out for medical services at LMDC. WellPath is the corporation that has been providing health care at the facility. Clearly, the number of deaths by suicide, their protocols for mental health and how they're screening people are not adequate, as that's been one of the drivers for death. So I hope that as that RFP process moves forward, I think that they are supposed to be early spring announcing who the new, or if they're going to continue with WellPath, who that medical provider will be. But I think that that's another area that doesn't get a lot of attention in the media, and folks don't even really know that that RFP is out.
WellPath is a multi-state corporation, and you can read a lot about how they are doing in other states, like Louisiana and other states, if you want to know more about that. WellPath has staffing problems, too, and it's easy to blame everything on WellPath. Well, it's just not that. If only it was that easy. A question in the very back.
Before the, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Before the pandemic, we had a program that was going to the jail semi-regularly, called 3101. We spent 4 days with them, and kind of got them excited about the possibility. It wasn't specific to substance abuse, but that's what we found there. But every time we go into jail, a lot of times we have to find our own grants, because they just didn't, so they didn't have any money for programs. So we would go in there and spend 4 days, but every time we walked in there, it reminded me of that old quote, when you're up to your ass in alligators, it's difficult to remember that your initial objective is to drain the swamp. Finding people that work there are really well-meaning people. We all have people wailing and rolling on the floor. And they had one section of people where they had a program. And this section of like maybe 18 women and two sections of men would get all the treatment programs that they had, whatever they had. And the jailer didn't seem to have, the head jailer didn't seem to have a whole lot of power to change that. And I actually live in Indiana. So talking about what people here can actually do, I think you might know more about what the pressure point actually is if it's the mayor and the council. They're the only ones that can do this. It's the jailer, I really don't think
The jailer works for the Metro Council, the director of the jail. You mentioned being able to go into the jail. This is much harder than ever before. There's no in-person visiting now. You can't mail a letter to a prisoner without that letter going somewhere and being copied, and the prisoner gets a copy of your letter. There is no library at our jail. You can't bring things that are printed in there and give them to anybody because of the whole drug issue. It's become much more inhumane. And this is statewide. And in fact, it takes less staff if you have all your visitation on video and you don't have to supervise a visiting room. Kate had a question.
Yes, Kyle. I wanted to follow up on what David James said, that we can't use the CCC because people are coming in and out. Does that make any sense to you?
It doesn't make sense to me. I believe he's thinking about the way that it's been used some in the past, where it was work release, so that some of the prisoners there would go out to work during the day and come back. This was an intermediate step, and so maybe he's thinking about that. But would it create an additional security issue with drugs coming in if we used it for anything? Yes, it would create a problem. But I don't see that as a reason to throw one-third of the jail away. I mean, the Community Corrections Center has bigger dormitories. They have two gymnasiums in there. They had a library. Correctional officers liked working there. It was a privilege to be there if you were a prisoner. So it was a step in the right direction. And so yesterday I got an email from somebody who told me that he knew about the plans to tear down the Community Corrections Center almost a year ago. So I don't know when this came about, but I was pretty much taken by surprise, and I've been watching for stuff at the jail. I think this is something that we could raise hell about. I don't understand. I just don't think, yes, we have fentanyl. I just don't think that's a reason to throw one-third of the jail away.
What's the address of this facility?
Well, it's in the 300 block of East Chestnut Street.
316 East Chestnut.
Bill.
Could it be because the hospital wants that land?
The question is, could it be because the hospital wants that land? I'm sure that's not true now, but next year, probably. Question.
Is there a group in Louisville that is mobilizing the Raising Hell and the movement to try to make a change?
I'm looking for you. I'm looking to get that group going any way I can. You know, I mean, I'm not the only former prison employee who feels this way, but I'm retired and I have time to work on this. And so, yes, I would like for there to be a group. There are people that are particularly interested. Jim Peterson here in the green shirt at the table next to you is a citizen activist, and I would encourage you to talk to him. Anytime I feel like I'm too tired, I think of Jim, and it perks me up.
Elsert has been speaking out about something.
Yes. Louisville Stand Up for Racial Justice has been speaking out. They use my research. Reporters' articles appear in the Courier. I see my work in there. I feel good about that. I don't care if my name's not in there. I'm too old to care about being famous. I've already been famous and nobody noticed. Frank.
This is more a question to us. And the first question is what Justice Reverend Phelps mentioned, is that what Kyle needs, he needs his support. Not a lot of people, but some, just like Kyle. The reason Kyle has effectiveness is because there's people power. So he needs that. The other thing is, he has told us the problem, and he played it out. We're spending untold amount of money, and it does not improve the lot of the average person. It doesn't improve our education, our mental health. Kyle has good facts, but we need good stories. So if you're a good storyteller, he needs you. He told us a couple of stories, but we need contemporary stories that help people see what's going on. Because without that struggle, and I'm glad that you're doing it, for your own
be thankful I didn't tell more stories. A question back here, yes.
There's a group which includes the ACLU, LSURG, Fairness, folks from Black Lives Matter, Vocal, KY, Core Justice Network, Global Family showing up. A lot of folks that meet, now we're meeting on a monthly basis. And you know, we've made some progress on these issues. We have a quarterly meeting with the corrections director. Folks may have heard last summer about an amnesty court, and we sort of rallied to get the justice partners to do an amnesty court with the idea of being like, we need strategies to keep people from going into this facility where folks are dying. We helped out a little bit and did some of the testing on the jail dashboard before that went live. So I have my cards with me if folks are interested to hop onto that call or to be with us for our efforts. We're happy to have you, Kyle, send us information.
Thank you.
We're happy to, we need all hands on deck.
Sure.
I have some important announcements to make, and after I make them, if you and Kyle want to stay for further questions, that's fine. But here's what I want to talk about. At your places, you've got this announcement for you all to take home and then show up on Sunday, October 29th. At the First Unitarian Church to hear Medea Benjamin talk about untangling the web of war in Ukraine. We should have had her program here a year and a half ago. We were not able to get on her book tour, but she has agreed to come here once her book tour is over to talk to us. She's going to talk about the context of how the war in Ukraine started many years ago, leading up to the war. We do not get that from our media. We do not get that from our State Department, our president. She's also going to talk about ways in which to bring this war to a negotiated end. If you notice that Noam Chomsky has made a statement here that is on the flyer. Fellowship of Reconciliation, very specifically, has always been involved in issues of war and bringing peace. That's how we got started back in 1915 in the middle of the First World War. So again, we have a commitment to bring Medea Benjamin and her information here. Carmichael's bookstore will bring copies of her book for you to buy and for Medea to autograph. If you want to get prepared for what she's going to talk about, you can buy her book right now at Carmichael's or anywhere else for about $17. It will give you a lot of background, which we all need to have. Because of the effort we've put into bringing Medea here in October, there will be no October lunch, no third Thursday lunch in October. We will be back for a third Thursday gathering in November. Right now, we don't know whether it will be in person again or via Zoom, but we will be mindful of what the health department at that point is telling us to do